Brilliant. Great. I think we're going to need all the help we can to stay awake. The late Saturday afternoon slot is not great at the best of time. The weather is getting lovely and warm, but that's not great for staying awake. And I gather that lots of people have done lots of really energetic things and want to fall asleep now. So I think if your neighbour looks as though they're falling asleep, prod them in the ribs gently, in love, of course. We've got the windows open wide in the front. Have we got them open wide at the back as well? Brilliant. I think keep them open just so we have lots of fresh air. We'll have a sing, I think, in the middle as well to try to keep us awake. I'm afraid this is also suffers a disadvantage of being the heaviest in some ways of the sessions, but hopefully not too heavy. It's my personal favourite. I think it's a really exciting thing we're looking at in this session. Before I get into that, though, let me just say by way of passing that this emphasis on Jesus' return and the new creation that I've been telling us about this morning is historical biblical Christianity. It's not a newfangled thing. We may feel it's not something we've spoken about a lot recently, but it's really slightly fallen off the radar recently. Whereas if you look a lot at the older hymns, they will almost always have a verse in them about Jesus' return and the new creation. It's part of historical Christianity. However, if you look at a lot of the older material, older hymns, older writings on the subject, they will refer to the new creation as heaven. And the reason why they do that is because the Bible sometimes talks of it as heaven and sometimes new creation. And in a previous generation, where the enemy hadn't won the propaganda battle of pretending that heaven is floating around on clouds being mindlessly bored, you could use heaven and new creation interchangeably. So that's why they call it heaven. So when you come across heaven or something like that, just think, if we had not been sold harps and clouds, we would think heaven equaled new creation, brilliant place. We'd like to be there. Let me come, though, to today's topic, or this afternoon's topic. In today's session, what I want to do is look at how the new creation becomes a big issue in the Bible. We've seen that the new creation is a radical, wonderful, really, really big deal in the New Testament. It's a huge Bible theme, but the place it really comes to preeminence is the New Testament. It's not been that big all the time. In the Old Testament, particularly near the beginning of the Old Testament, it's not a big deal at all. In fact, in the beginning of the Old Testament, it's a really very small deal. So how does the Bible make the shift from not a big deal near the beginning of the Bible to huge deal at the end of the Bible? As I said last night when Roger was interviewing me, the Bible is a narrative. It's an account of God's plan worked out in practice. It's not just a flat story. You couldn't interchange the books. You couldn't put Exodus in the New Testament and take Romans and put it as the second book of the Bible. The account has moved on. God's plan has moved on. Things have happened that means that God does things differently. But how did he get from a focus on this world to a focus on the new creation? That's what I wanted to look at now. Let me set the problem up even more acutely. As the account of God's plan unfolds, as the Bible works through the first hundreds of years, thousands of years of history, the idea of a new creation, of life after death, gets no explicit mention for a very long time indeed. It is not there in the early history of Israel, or in the early history of the world. So every time, all the Bible up to the time of Abraham, new creation, heaven doesn't get mentioned at all, apart from heavens meaning sky. But the idea of eternity, heaven, doesn't get mentioned once. At the time of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and the patriarchs, it doesn't get mentioned at all. At the time of the Exodus and the conquest of the land, it doesn't get mentioned at all. In the time of the early period of Israel's occupation of the land, it doesn't get mentioned at all. It really only starts getting mentioned towards the back end of Israel's history in the Old Testament. Around the time of the exile is the time we get the first mentions of the new creation. How so? Why is it that you have this long period right up to about the 8th century BC with no mention of the new creation, and then you get to the New Testament, and it's front and center everywhere. And this world has almost dropped out of the emphasis, except as a place where we live and journey through, waiting for the new creation to come. How has that happened? How is it that God's focus has shifted away from the nation of Israel, a physical group of people, in the land of Canaan, a physical land, enjoying physical blessings of lots of crops and your animals having lots of young and you getting lots of rain so your crop prospered and your enemies not defeating you, to heaven, eternity, a new creation, which is a completely different world? How does the Bible make that story? Just in passing, I ought to say, for those of you who know your Bible, you'll know that in the New Testament, Jesus says, actually, Abraham was aware of it as well. And Hebrews 11 says, the heroes of faith, which you look at this Thursday, they knew of it as well, that there was this new eternity. But it's not explicit. So men of faith were aware there was something more. But God had not yet revealed it in his word that there was anything more. The story focuses entirely on this world. And it's not just that as we get closer and closer to the coming of Jesus, that the new creation gets more airtime just because we're getting closer. There's some of that. But what I hope that we will see in this afternoon session is that the shift of focus from this world to the new creation is a necessary part of God's plan. He gets there entirely intentionally, entirely deliberately, necessarily, because his plan can only reach fulfillment and climax and culmination because of the new creation. If you didn't have the new creation, God's plan would not work. The new creation is not a random accident. It is a necessary and essential part of God's plan. And that's what I hope that we'll see this afternoon. I think it's really, really important we understand this, because a lot of confusion among a lot of Christians today stems from not understanding what we should expect in this world and what we should expect in the new creation. We get very muddled. A lot of Christians get very muddled. How much should we expect now? How much should we expect then? And they assume that in order to work out how much we can expect now, we can look anywhere in the Bible story and draw lessons. So if something back in Exodus says, let's focus on something in this world, they say, oh, that must mean we can now. But if you realize that the account of God's plan has moved on, God's plan isn't a static thing, but a dynamic, moving thing, and it has moved from here to there, then of course it's no longer legitimate to go right back to the beginning and say, we're there. But that's what a lot of people do. So all the people who focused on the fact that, for instance, Christians should really spend a lot of time and energy on reforming society, developing things so that the world is different, society is different, people are different, they justify that by going back to the Old Testament, particularly the beginning part of the Old Testament. But if it is true, and I hope to show it, that the story has moved on, God's plan has progressed, that is not a legitimate thing to do. You have to say, we're not there in the story. That was then, we're here. So that's what I'm trying to do this afternoon. Conversely, I have argued that God's focus is there. If we can't see how God got from here to there and why it's necessary, am I right to say that God is focusing there? Is the focus maybe still much more here? So showing us this afternoon that the plan gets from there to there, not accidentally, not randomly, not just by chance, but entirely necessarily, I think is a really important part of me trying to prove the case to you that the new creation is what matters, and conversely, that therefore doing things that reforming this world isn't that big a deal. You can't just go back to the early Old Testament and say it was big then, so it must be big now. So again, that is part of the agenda for this afternoon. Again, I think an ambitious and quite exciting agenda to help us see how God's plan works. This movement from a focus on this world to a focus on the new creation happens in the second half of the Old Testament. It's the bit we tend to skip over because we don't understand it. By this stage in the overview, you will know that, if you just think about it for a second, that all the time in the first term, when you were looking at the Old Testament, certainly up to David, Solomon, probably until the prophets, you didn't get any mention of heaven, the new creation, did you? Eternal life. It just didn't turn up. This term in the New Testament, it's been there everywhere. So you're aware that shift has happened, but you may not have actually thought how, why, when. You might also be vaguely aware that there's a big chunk of the Old Testament you have not thought about and studied. About a third, I put bookmarks in my Bible just so we could find it. That first third, my left hand, that bit, that's the historical books of the Bible. That's the bit we tend to be quite familiar with, the story of Abraham and the Exodus and David and the kingdom and the exile. That bit is the New Testament. That bit, which is about a third of the Bible, is the bit we hardly ever study and don't know much about. It's the wisdom literature, the Psalms, the prophets. You did a couple of passages, I think, from the prophets, but you tend to dip in and those promises from Isaiah and Ezekiel, they just come from nowhere. But how did we get there? What's happening? And those two questions of how we get from focus on this world to focus on the next world, and what that big middle third of the Bible is doing, they're actually linked questions. They're one and the same question. That shift happens in that middle third. There are a lot of things that are happening in that middle third. As you can imagine, God doesn't waste words. So when a third of the Bible is happening, the plot is moving on in all sorts of ways. One of the most important ways in which the plot moves on in that middle third is from a shift of emphasis from this world to a new creation. And that's what I want us to see this afternoon. So one of the fringe benefits of this afternoon, I hope, we'll be filling in some of the gaps in the overview that we've been thinking about all year. Let me begin with how the story begins to move on. The first place where the story begins to move on off this world. And it happens in what is known as the wisdom literature. The wisdom literature is the books of Proverbs and Job and Ecclesiastes and the Song of Solomon. It's the first books after what we tend to think of as history. The idea of wisdom and the literature associated with it becomes a big deal at the time of Solomon. So if you remember, where are my pens? That was Abraham. Somewhere around there, we'll say, you got David and you got Solomon. You get the monarchy arising. And it's around that time that wisdom becomes a big deal. You can see that, just in passing, small detail, in Solomon's prayer at the beginning of his reign. Jesse, thank you so much for reading for us. Could you read again for us 1 Kings chapter 3, verses 5 to 12, please?
At Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream by night, and God said, "Ask what I shall give you." And Solomon said, "You have shown great and steadfast love to your servant David, my father, because he walked before you in faithfulness, in righteousness, and in uprightness of heart towards you. And you have kept for him this great and steadfast love, and have given him a son to sit on his throne this day. And now, O Lord my God, you have made your servant king in place of David, my father, although I am but a little child. I do not know how to go out or come in. And your servant is in the midst of your people, whom you have chosen, a great people, too many to be numbered or counted for multitude. Give your servant, therefore, an understanding mind to govern your people, that I may discern between good and evil. For who is able to govern this, your great people?"
Thank you. So what does he pray for? He prays for an understanding mind. Why that? Why not righteousness or something else, which would seem to us to be a very sensible thing to pray for, wouldn't it? But no, it's an understanding mind he prays for. It's wisdom he wants. And whether it's because he prays for wisdom that it becomes a big deal, or whether it's already become a big deal and therefore he prays for it, we don't know, and it doesn't matter. At around that time, it becomes a really big deal. And Solomon is considered then the wisest man in the Bible. So that's his epitaph at the end, the wisest man in the world. The world went to hear his wisdom. The Queen of Sheba turned up to hear his wisdom. He wrote most of Proverbs, most of Ecclesiastes, the Song of Solomon. Just think about where we are. When I say that wisdom becomes a big deal there, that is the height of the monarchy. That is the point in Israel's history, you will remember, when the fulfillment of God's promises in this world is most close to happening. That is when the kingdom has fully been conquered by the nation of Israel. The land is at its fullest extent. It's most blessed. It's most at peace. Insofar as there's fulfillment of God's plan in this world, it happens at the time of David and Solomon, just when wisdom is hitting its peak. And that is not accidental, as we'll see in a second. They go hand in hand together. Much of the wisdom literature was written at that point, at the height of the monarchy, at the height of Israel's triumph in this world. Some of it was written a bit later. Some of it was written probably earlier, but really became front and center at the time of the monarchy. That's when it became a really big deal. What I want to do now is to focus on two of the wisdom books to help us see how they begin the process of moving the story forward off this world onto the new creation. The other wisdom books do something very similar, but these two are probably the best examples. Let's begin with the book of Job. You might need to turn to Job. We'll be in Job for quite a long time. It's at the end of all the books you tend to think of as history and before the Psalms, about a third of the way through. Let's begin. Well, Job is the story of a righteous man who God is pleased with, but God allows Satan to make Job suffer, even though Job is righteous and a sinless man. Jesse, could you read Job chapter 1, verse 1, please? They're whole strings. Let's begin with Job 1, verse 1.
There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil.
Thank you. Don't sit down. Blameless and upright, feared God. Can you read verses 6 to 12 as well, please?
Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. The Lord said to Satan, "From where have you come?" Satan answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro on the earth, and from walking up and down on it." And the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, who fears God and turns away from evil?" Then Satan answered the Lord and said, "Does Job fear God for no reason? Have you not put a hedge around him and his house and all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face." And the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, all that he has is in your hand. Only against him do not stretch out your hand." So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord.
Thank you. Don't bother sitting down. We're going to get you up again in 10 seconds. But just notice that when Job 1:1 says that Job was a blameless man, God himself attests to that. He's a blameless man. There is no one like him in all the world. Job is, Satan's being allowed to tempt him, just, if you like, almost to prove a point between Satan and God. Job is innocent. Can you read 1:20 to 2:10 as well, please? Quite a big reading, I'm sorry.
Then Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head and fell on the ground and worshipped. And he said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." In all this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrong. Again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them to present himself before the Lord. And the Lord said to Satan, "From where have you come?" Satan answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro on the earth, and from walking up and down on it." And the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil? He still holds fast his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without reason." Then Satan answered the Lord and said, "Skin for skin, all that a man stretch out your hand and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse you to your face." And the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, he is in your hand, only spare his life. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and struck Job with loathsome sores from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And he took a piece of broken pottery with which to scrape himself while he sat in the ashes. Then his wife said to him, "Still hold fast your integrity. Curse God and die." But he said to her, "You speak as one of the foolish women would speak. Shall we receive good from God, and shall we not receive evil?" In all this, Job did not sin with his lips.
Thank you. So Job is an innocent and blameless man. God allows Satan to make him suffer. First of all, in the bit we didn't read, in taking away all his family and his material prosperity and his security, and then even against himself and his health. And in all of that, he still doesn't sin and still does the right thing. The rest of the book is about four friends who come to visit Job in his suffering. And it's long, long conversation. So we get 40 chapters or so of conversation between Job and his friends, just reflecting upon the problem of suffering. And why is it Job is suffering like this? Now, it's really important. The key to the book is understanding that we, the readers, know that Job is suffering through no fault of his own. He is a righteous man. But the people on the ground don't know that. Okay? Job doesn't know that. He just knows he's suffering. His friends don't know he's a righteous, blameless man who God isn't judging. They just know he's suffering. So the people on the ground just know Job is suffering badly. They don't know that God thinks he's blameless anyway. The comforters argue, they're called comforters, but they really aren't, which is why Job comforters has turned up in the English language as somebody who's trying to comfort but is failing dismally. The comforters argue that God is a just God. So if Job is suffering, it must be because he sinned. Do you see their logic? Job, you're suffering. God is just. He would make you suffer if you hadn't sinned. So you must have sinned. We may not have seen your sin. You must have sinned in secret somewhere. But if you have suffered, you must have sinned. That's their logic. And if this world is all there is, they are right. You cannot square a just and powerful God with person suffering without sin. Does that make sense? If Job is absolutely sinless and he suffers and that's it and there's nothing afterwards, God is not being fair to Job. The comforters are absolutely right. If this world is all there is. Job, in his defense, says vehemently that he knows that God is just, but he knows he hasn't sinned. We know that's true. Job, therefore, says something is wrong. Something doesn't make sense here. Jesse, can you read Job 10, verses 1 to 9, please?
I loathe my life. I will give free utterance to my complaint. I will speak in the bitterness of my soul. I will say to God, "Do not condemn me. Let me know why you contend against me. Does it seem good to you to oppress, to despise the work of your hands and favor the designs of the wicked? Have you eyes of flesh? Do you see as man sees? Are your days as the days of man, or your years as a man's years, that you seek out my iniquity and search for my sin, although you know that I am not guilty, and there is none to deliver out of your hand? Your hands fashioned and made me, and now you have destroyed me altogether. Remember that you have made me like clay, and will you return me to dust?"
Thank you. So he's pleading with God, "Look, I didn't do anything wrong. Why are you destroying me?" In fact, as part of his argument, he points out that not only is he a righteous man suffering, but the other side of the equation is also true. The wicked often prosper. So, Jesse, can you read again, please, Job chapter 21, verses 7 to 15?
"Why do the wicked live, reach old age, and grow mighty in power? Their offspring are established in their presence, and their descendants before their eyes. Their houses are safe from fear, and no rod of God is upon them. Their bull breeds without fail. Their cow calves and does not miscarry. They send out their little boys like a flock, and their children dance. They sing to the tambourine and the lyre and rejoice to the sound of the pipe. They spend their days in prosperity, and in peace they go down to Sheol. They say to God, "Depart from us. We do not desire the knowledge of your ways. What is the Almighty that we should serve him? And what profit do we get if we pray to him?"
Thank you. Up to verse 15. Yep. Thank you very much. Good. So that's the second part of Job's argument. So Job's defense of himself is, I'm sinless, but I'm still suffering. I don't understand. It doesn't make sense. And he says, look around you. The wicked people, you know they're wicked. You can see they're wicked. And they're happy and they're prosperous and their children are doing well. And it doesn't make sense, God, is what he says. On the other side, the comforters are saying, ooh, Job, you're suffering. You must have sinned somewhere. Flip right through to the end of the book and see God's verdict. Jesse, could you read chapter 42, verse 7, please? This is God's verdict at the very end of the story. Last chapter.
After the Lord has spoken these words to Job, the Lord said to Eliphaz the Temanite,
who's the one of the comforters, sorry. Keep going.
My anger burns against you and against your two friends, for you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has.
Thank you. So Job in what he's saying is right, and the comforters are wrong. But how? Because it looks like the comforters are right. If this world is all it is, the comforters' argument makes sense. Neither Job nor the comforters, nor anywhere in the book is there any real awareness of anything beyond this world. It's just, it doesn't make sense. If this world is everything, it doesn't make sense. And that's more or less where the book stops. There's the tiniest hint of maybe there's something. If only there were something else, it would solve it. But there's nothing developed. There's just nothing to give you an answer to the problem. It's a problem set up. Why is it that the righteous suffer and the wicked prosper? It's a book which basically says it just doesn't seem to make sense. In fact, at the heart of the book is a passage where Job bemoans the fact that wisdom, in other words, the answer to his question of how do I make sense of all of this, can't be found in this world. All that God has revealed so far is that people must fear God despite all questions. That's the beginning of wisdom. They must fear God even though they can't make sense of the world. Jesse, can you read this? This is a lovely passage on wisdom not being found. Job 28, verses 12 to 28.
But where shall wisdom be found? And where is the place of understanding? Man does not know its worth, and it is not found in the land of the living. The deep says, it is not in me. And the sea says, it is not with me. It cannot be bought for gold, and silver cannot be weighed as its price. It cannot be valued in the gold of Ophir, in precious onyx or sapphire. Gold and glass cannot equal it, nor can it be exchanged for jewels of fine gold. No mention shall be made of coral or of crystal. The price of wisdom is above pearls. The topaz of Ethiopia cannot equal it, nor can it be valued in pure gold. From where, then, does wisdom come? And where is the place of understanding? It is hidden from the eyes of all living and concealed from the birds of the air. Abaddon and death say, we have heard a rumor of it with our ears. God understands the way to it, and he knows its place. For he looks to the ends of the earth and sees everything under the heavens. When he gave to the wind its weight and apportioned the waters by measure, when he made a decree for the rain and a way for the lightning of the thunder, then he saw it and declared it. He established it and searched it out. And he said to man, behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. And to turn away from evil is understanding.
Thank you. So wisdom, where is it to be found? It's beyond price. You can't buy it anywhere. You can't find it. No living being knows it. Not the animals, not the people. Even things like death itself, they don't know it. All they've heard is the merest rumor that there might be an answer to the problem. All he knows is, this is what you have to get on with. be righteous. Fear God. But there's no answer to the problem. Why do the righteous suffer and the wicked prosper? So the point of the book is that if all we have is this world, there is no answer to the problem of how you square a just and powerful God with the observation that righteous people suffer and wicked people often prosper. And at this point in the story, God has not yet revealed the answer to that. The problem is particularly acute when you put that individual book together with a Bible story, that what God has revealed in the Mosaic Covenant, remember the Mosaic Covenant comes at this point in the plot. So somewhere around there, you get the Mosaic Covenant, a while before this book really becomes a big thing. If you think, remember back to, it would have been probably November, December, when you looked at the Mosaic Covenant. All the Mosaic Covenant is focused on this world. If you obey God's commands, you will get the land of Canaan. You will live in it long. You will prosper in it. You won't have enemies that will destroy you in it. But if you disobey in this world, you will get cursed in this world. You will suffer drought in the world. Your crops will fail in the world. You will starve in the world. You'll be sick in the world. And in the end, you'll be chucked out of the land of Canaan, which is a land in this world. The Mosaic Covenant is entirely this world focused. So what the book of Job effectively is a meditation on the problems of focusing on this world, whether you look at the individual or whether you look at the nation and the corporate promises that God has made. If you focus on this world, it just doesn't seem to work. No answers are given in the book of Job or up to this point in the story. The problem is just posed. The question is asked. What do we do? How do we square this? Something isn't quite right. Now, before we go any further, because I suspect we're all quite sleepy, we're going to have a bit of a sing. And it's not a random song. This is one of my favorites. It's When Peace Like a River. Many of us will know the story of that song. The man who wrote it was a fine Christian man who... I think the story is he sent his wife and his children on a boat ahead of him. And there was a terrible storm at sea, and they were lost. I've heard two accounts. One is the whole family was lost, the other was just the children. But whichever it is, to lose either all your children or your wife and all your children is a terrible fate. He was a godly Christian man, and this terrible thing happened to him. It's like Job. But it's different because this is written after Jesus. So let's sing it. Great song with reflection on the difference. Well, I'll comment on it after. Do we need to pull the screen down? Yes. Thank you. Just look at that last verse, which I've asked Matt to keep up for us. How does this godly man reconcile the fact that he has lost his family to a storm at sea? The answer is the resolution comes because he's aware that the sky, not the grave, is our goal. The trumpet shall sound, the Lord shall descend. Bless the Lord, O my soul. He has the answer, but Job didn't. That answer is what makes sense, but you need that. Thanks, Matt. We can turn that off. I hope you can get back that back out again. So that's Job. Life doesn't make sense. You can't make sense of suffering and why the wicked prosper if this world is everything. Another wisdom book is Ecclesiastes. That seems to have been written by Solomon. It claims to be written by a descendant of David who is king, who is incredibly prosperous. And the only one who matches all the details is Solomon. though it doesn't explicitly say it's Solomon. The purpose of the book is to argue that if this world is all there is, then life is pointless. You find the phrase vanity of vanities turning up quite regularly in the book. This is the one time I'm going to play the language card. The word vanity of vanities, vanity, translates a Hebrew word which is quite difficult to put into English. It basically says it is transient, it's ephemeral, it's meaningless. So some translations call it meaningless, meaningless. It's the word you use of a morning mist in the Middle East. You know, those of you who know anything about the Middle East, the sun is very hot. The mist lasts minutes and then gets burnt off. This is the word you use for that. It just, it's gone. So when it says vanity of vanity, it basically means transient, passing. Like morning mist in a hot sun, it just goes. There's nothing there. It sounds quite a depressing book to say that all of life is meaningless, transient, passing. But actually, it's an incredibly insightful book that a lot of people really love. But a key argument for why life is so pointless, if this world is everything, is that everybody dies in the end, and that levels everything. There is no reason to be wiser. There's no reason to be more righteous. There's no reason to be richer. There's no reason for anything if death in the end ends everything. Let's have a look at a couple of passages just to see this point being made. Jesse, could you read Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verses 12 to 23? To find Ecclesiastes, from Job, go forward past Psalms, past Proverbs, and it's the next book. Ecclesiastes 2, 12 to 23.
So I turn to consider wisdom and madness and folly. But what can the man do who comes after the king? Only what has already been done. Then I saw that there is more gain in wisdom than in folly, as there is more gain in light than in darkness. The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. And yet, I perceive that the same event happens to all of them. Then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool? What happens to me also? Why then have I been so very wise? And I said in my heart that this also is vanity. For of the wise, as of the fool, there is no enduring remembrance, seeing that in the days to come, all will have been long forgotten. How the wise dies just like the fool. So I hated life, because what is done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity and a striving after wind. I hated all my toil in which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me, and who knows whether he will be a wise or a fool. Yet he will be master of all, for which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This also is vanity.
Up to 23, please.
So I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labors under the sun. Because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. What has a man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are full of sorrow, and his work is a vexation. Even in the night his heart does not rest. This also is vanity.
Thank you. And can you also read chapter 9, verses 1 to 6, please?
But all this I laid to heart, examining it all, how the righteous and the wise and their deeds are in the hand of God. Whether it is love or hate, man does not know. Both are before him. It is the same for all, since the same event happens to the righteous and the wicked, to the good and the evil, to the clean and the unclean, to him who sacrifices and to him who does not sacrifice. As is the good, so is the sinner. And he who swears is as he who shuns an oath. This is an evil in all that is done under the sun, that the same event happens to all. Also, the hearts of the children of man are full of evil, and madness is in their hearts while they live, and after that they go to the dead. But he who is joined with all the living has hope, for a living dog is better than a dead lion. For the living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing, and they have no more reward, for the memory of them is forgotten. Their love and their hate and their envy have already perished, and forever they have no more share in all that is done under the sun.
Thank you. Did you notice all of that? It doesn't matter if you're good or wise or hardworking or righteous. The same thing will happen to you, even if you're a sinner or a fool or lazy. It's better to be a living dog than a dead wise man. As far as Solomon is concerned, there is nothing beyond this world. Death ends it all, and that just makes the whole of life futile and pointless. Solomon still knows it is better to be wise and righteous, but he doesn't understand why. God has said, be wise, be righteous. But he doesn't know why, because it doesn't make sense. Because if death ends it all, why bother? Why work really hard and be really wise and make lots of money to leave it to your son, when your son will be a wastrel and squanders it? I mean, the history of 2,000 years, well, more than that, has shown that is absolutely right. How many estates have lasted? The depredations of the children. It just gets squandered and thrown away. And Solomon doesn't have an answer to that. All he knows is that there's a problem if this world is everything. In passing, as part of his argument, he also points out that even if one is blessed in this world, even for the time you have the blessing, you might think, oh, well, okay, we all die, the same thing happens. But at least for while you're alive, you get blessed. No, says Solomon. Even that blessing is a disappointment. Jesse, can you read chapter 2, verses 1 to 12, please?
1 to 11,
thank you very much. Yes, I can't read my own notes.
I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad. And of pleasure, what use is it? I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house. I had also great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delight of the children of man. So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also, my wisdom remained with me, and whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was my reward for all my toil. Then I considered all that my hands had done, and the toil I had expended in doing it, and behold, all was vanity and a striving after wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun.
Depressing, isn't it? But here you get the wisest man in the world, the king of Israel, who had everything. He had wisdom, he had fame, he had power, he gave himself everything he wanted, he drank all the wine he wanted, he had all the laughter he wanted, he had all the pleasure he wanted, he had all the possessions he wanted, and he considered what he had, and it was ashes in his mouth. And the wise and the rich and the famous today still say the same thing, don't they? Riches don't buy prosperity. You just have to look at the press almost every day in the media. Some rich, famous person's committing suicide or something like that. It doesn't buy happiness. It is pointless. Even if you're blessed in this world, it's not worth having. So one of the big messages of the wisdom literature is that if this world is all there is, we've got big problems. Life is pointless. Even more important than that, all God's revelation up to this point just doesn't work. Often the righteous aren't blessed and the wicked aren't judged. It doesn't work. And even if it happens to work for a while and you are getting some blessings as a result, they're not worth having anyway. Something is wrong. The writers of the wisdom books know this can't be right. They know it's a problem. You get the sense of this isn't right. There is an answer somewhere. Why is it like this? But they don't know the answer. They just know the question. They just know the problem because the answer has not yet been revealed in the story. They seem to appreciate just at points, tiny little glimpses, that there must be more than this world, but God has not yet said anything about it. Let's just have a look at a brief passage which makes that point. Ecclesiastes 3, verses 19 to 21. Jesse, could you read that for us, please?
For what happens to the children of man and what happens to the beast is the same. As one dies, so does the other. They all have the same breath, and man has no advantage over the beast, for all his vanity. All go to one place. All are from the dust, into dust all return. Who knows whether the spirit of man goes upward and the spirit of the beast goes down into the earth? So I saw that there is nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his work, for that is his lot. Who can bring him to see what will be after him?
Who can bring him to see what will be after him? Who knows if that the soul of man goes up and the soul of the animals go down? We don't know. Maybe. But we don't know. God has not yet revealed it. So at this point in the story, around there, they're beginning to see there's a problem with this world being everything. There must be something more, but they don't know the answer because in God's evolving, developing plan, he has not yet revealed the answer to that problem. He's just begun to reveal that there is a problem. Now, what I want us to do now is just for 2 or 3 minutes, in groups of twos and threes again, just talk about that. Discuss what you feel about the fact that God has said, and our experience really confirms in many ways, that if you just have this world, it's all meaningless and pointless and it doesn't work, that there's a problem. Just how does that make you feel? Angry? Does it suddenly make sense of a lot of things that you've observed in life? Does it make you thrilled that there actually is a new creation? Don't focus so much on that one. Just focus on the problems that exist if this world is all. Imagine you were back there at the time of David and Solomon. This world is everything. How would you feel? Good. Let's call ourselves to order there. Good, let's come back together. So by the time of the monarchy, at the height of Israel's prosperity, when it looks like she's got everything that this world has to offer, it looks like she's got the promises of the Mosaic Covenant, it's precisely at that point that God says, actually it isn't. And they know it. They know it doesn't work. They feel it. And it doesn't work. But the answer to this conundrum is only revealed, or only begins to be revealed, about 200 years after the time of Solomon, when the prophets begin to speak. Particularly Isaiah, who is a key prophet in this. It's a very, very important book. Isaiah is very frequently quoted and alluded to in the New Testament. And in the book of Isaiah, many things are revealed for the first time in the unfolding of God's salvation plan. Isaiah, the prophets and Isaiah, they're around there. And Isaiah begins to reveal for the first time that there's an answer to some of the problems. Isaiah begins, like the wisdom literature, by pointing out that there's a problem with God's plan as it's worked out in this world. Isaiah's angle is slightly different. His angle is that every time God rescues Israel in this world, the rescue is only temporary. A very frequently recurring feature of the whole of Israel's history, not just Isaiah, is that this cycle, you will know from your time in the overview, Israel sins, God judges her, she repents, God rescues her, she sins, God judges her, she repents, God rescues her, and the cycle just keeps going on and on and on and on. If you know anything about the book of Judges, you know it goes round and round and round and round and round. And that's what we see, too, in Isaiah. Isaiah prophesies over a period of about 50 years. to the kingdom of Judah, which is the southern kingdom. In that period, there are two major crises and several minor ones, but two major crises. The first is when Judah is attacked by the northern kingdom of Israel in alliance with Syria, and the second when she's attacked by Assyria at around the time that the northern kingdom of Israel is destroyed. On each occasion, God rescues Judah, but at the same time as he's rescuing here, he predicts the next disaster and also the fact that there will be another rescue after that. So the book begins, after a brief introduction, with the crisis when the northern kingdom of Israel and the nation of Syria attack Judah. And God says, don't worry, I will rescue you from them. But Assyria will come, but she'll only come up to the neck, and then I'll send her back. And then when Assyria comes and actually does attack, God stops her supernaturally at the gates of Jerusalem. You'll know the story. The angel of the Lord went out one night and destroyed 180-something thousand Assyrian soldiers, and Jerusalem was saved. But at the same time as that's happening, God is saying, yes, but Babylon is coming next, and you'll be taken into exile in Babylon. And after that, Cyrus will arise and bring you back from Babylon. And the cycle will keep going on and on because there's no peace for the wicked. The point that Isaiah is making is that in this world, neither judgment for sin nor rescue from that judgment will ever be an adequate solution. They will not solve the problem of sin. They will not solve the problem of other people's sin and enemies arising and destroying you. There is nothing you can do in this world. You will keep sinning. Enemies will keep sinning. Destruction will happen. Things will go wrong. There is no solution in this world, is Isaiah. The cycle will just keep going on and on. Even if God comes and rescues, the wheel will just turn and you'll get more judgment and more rescue. But where Isaiah differs from the wisdom literature, where the prophets differ from the wisdom literature, is at last we find God revealing that there is a proper solution. There will be a king on David's throne who will bring about everlasting peace. God himself. A very familiar passage that we know from Christmas, but it's so great. We'll get Jesse to read it. Jesse, Isaiah chapter 9, verses 2 to 7, please.
The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who dwelt in a land of deep darkness, on them has light shined. You have multiplied the nation, you have increased its joy. They rejoice before you as with joy at the harvest, as they are glad when they divide the spoil. For the yoke of his burden and the staff for his shoulder, the rod of his oppressor, you have broken as on the day of Midian. For every boot of the tramping warrior in battle tumult, and every garment rolled in blood, will be burned as fuel for the fire. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. And of the increase of his government and of peace there will be no end. On the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it with justice and with righteousness from this time forth and forevermore. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this.
Thank you. A great king on David's throne, God himself, and as a result, permanent peace. This cycle of endless judgment and salvation broken because of this great king on the throne. But Isaiah doesn't stop there. He goes on in chapter 52 and 53 to talk about a sacrifice who will actually deal with the problem of sin. Again, we know this passage, but again, it's so great that, Jesse, would you mind reading chapter 52, verse 13 to 53, verse 6, please?
Behold, my servant shall act wisely. He shall be high and lifted up and shall be exalted. As many were astonished at you, his appearance was so marred beyond human semblance, and his form beyond that of the children of mankind. So shall he sprinkle many nations. Kings shall shut their mouths because of him. For that which has not been told them they see, and that which they have not heard they understand. Who has believed what they heard from us? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he grew up before him like a young plant, and like a root out of dry ground. He had no form or majesty that we should look at him, and no beauty that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And as one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised, and we esteemed him not. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. Yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace, and with his stripes we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned every one to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. So, a great king who will bring perfect peace, a perfect sacrifice who will deal with the problem of sin that's causing all the problems in the first place. But more than that, part of the package of what God is doing is a new creation, as we saw in chapter 65, in which death itself will be defeated. Jesse, can you read chapter 25, verses 6 to 8, please?
On this mountain, the Lord of hosts will make for all peoples a feast of rich food, a feast of well-aged wine, of rich food full of marrow, of aged wine well-refined. And he will swallow up on this mountain the covering that is cast over all peoples, the veil that is spread over all nations. He will swallow up death forever. And the Lord God will wipe away tears from all faces, and the reproach of his people he will take away from all the earth, for the Lord has spoken.
Thank you. And before you sit down, can you also read 26:19, please?
Your dead shall live, their bodies shall rise. You who dwell in the dust, awake and sing for joy, for your dew is a dew of light, and the earth will give birth to the dead.
Thank you. So do you see there in the middle of the book, you're getting the promise that death will be defeated. Death will be swallowed up, but it doesn't just mean people from now on won't die. Your dead will rise out of the graves. Resurrection is promised as well. And we saw in the first session, and we won't get us to read it again just because of time, but Isaiah is also the book where you get this tremendous description of the new creation, of the lion lying down with the lamb, of new heavens and of new earth in which nothing goes wrong. Isaiah is the place where God reveals that there is a massive solution to the massive problems. The problems of sin and judgment never ending are solved by a perfect solution to sin and a perfect answer to the problems, the cursed world we live in, a new creation. They come together as a package. When the solution to the problem of sin is revealed, the solution to the problem of a fallen world is also revealed, new creation. You can't separate the two. You can't get sin dealt with without a new creation. You can't get a new creation without sin dealt with. The two go together as a package. Fully forgiven, sin-free people can only enjoy the blessings that will entail in a new creation. The new creation can only be inhabited by sinless, forgiven people. They come together, and only God can accomplish all of this. So if you like, Isaiah at that point in the story looks forward, and he sees God coming down out of heaven. He sees the death of God's Son as a sacrifice. He sees that new creation coming as a result of the fact that people are now transformed. Basically, Isaiah is prophesying everything apart from the fact that Jesus' coming comes in two bites. That happens later on. That's revealed in the New Testament. Can you see how as the plan evolves, new things are revealed? It's not a static plan. You can't look at what God is doing back there and assume it's the same as here. It isn't. Things are moving on. The plan is evolving. Not because God had made a mistake, not because he's changed his mind. He's just revealing more and more of it as the story unfolds. And Isaiah reveals sin dealt with and new creation, as only God can do. And therefore, the problem of the endless cycle of sin and judgment and rescue, which means that God's promises of a permanent land and blessings can't be fulfilled, is now dealt with by God. There is no solution for the problems of this world within this world, but that is not a problem for God. He will just make a new creation. So stay in this world, and you cannot break the cycle. It'll be sin, judgment, rescue, sin, judgment, rescue, sin, judgment, rescue. It goes on and on and on in this world. Fine, not a problem. New creation with a rescue for it. That is God's answer to the problem. And in a stroke, can you see how all the other problems raised in the wisdom literature are also dealt with? There's an apparent lack of justice in this world. But if there's a new creation, there's no lack of justice overall. That's just been meted out later on. And Isaiah makes that point explicit. Isaiah is clear that the wicked won't inherit God's new creation. Atonement for sin is not for everyone. It is only for the humble and contrite. Jesse, can you read chapter 66, 1 and 2, and also 22 to 24, please? Isaiah 66, 1 and 2, and 22 to 24.
Thus says the Lord, heaven is my throne, and the earth is my footstool. What is the house that you would build for me, and what is the place of my rest? All these things my hand has made. And so all these things came to be, declares the Lord. But this is the one to whom I will look, he who is humble and contrite in spirit and trembles at my word. For as the new heavens and the new earth that I make shall remain before me, says the Lord, so shall your offspring and your name remain. From new moon to new moon and from Sabbath to Sabbath, all flesh shall come to worship before me, declares the Lord. And they shall go out and look on the dead bodies of the men who have rebelled against me. For their worm shall not die, their fire shall not be quenched, and they shall be an abhorrence to all flesh.
Thank you. So the humble and the contrite, they will be saved. They will get the new creation. The wicked and the rebels, they will be judged forever. In many ways, that's really probably the first mention of hell as well, as a place of eternal judgment beyond which there's no rescue, gets mentioned, though that's less clear. It's not just that the lack of justice is solved in this world, and God's plan can now be fulfilled. You can now get the blessings. Righteousness does get a reward. Life in this world is no longer pointless if death doesn't end everything. If there's life after death, if there are blessings there that truly satisfy, which there will be, then life now is not pointless. All the questions raised, all the problems posed in the wisdom literature and in the prophets gets resolved by the answer, new creation and a rescue for it. That's why Isaiah is probably the most important book in the Old Testament and is quoted left, right and center throughout the New Testament as Jesus comes and begins to fulfill all that Isaiah prophesied. No wonder the New Testament just keeps looking back to Isaiah and saying, look, Isaiah said it, Isaiah said it, Isaiah said it. It's there in the other prophets, or some of the other prophets as well, but not in quite such an obvious and big way. They're doing something slightly different. But it's there mentioned more in some of the later prophets. What I want us to do now, again in twos and threes, is just discuss how you feel about God solving the problems of the fallen world in such a radical manner. Sort of, right, this world, let's have a new one. That all the problems solved in one stroke by a God who made this world in the first place and can make the new one just as easily with a word and has said he will, and that's the real one. Just discuss with your neighbor how you feel about this radical solution to the problems of this world. Good. Let's begin to wrap up our discussion there. Good. Now, again, I don't know quite what you said in your groups. I don't know whether you thought this was an absolutely thrilling thing that God was solving the problems of the world in such a radical, sort of one stroke of the pen way, or whether you got quite cross and grumpy with God and thought, why is he just giving up on this world like this and having a new one? It doesn't matter whether we're thrilled by it or frustrated by it. That's what God has said he is doing. That is the way God has chosen to solve the problem. Let me try to sum up. Until the time of David and Solomon, the height of the kingdom on this world, it looks like this world is all there is. But when we get to having as many blessings in this world as Israel ever gets, God shows that it's not that. If this world was all, then it'd be inconsistent with the facts that we see, that the righteous don't prosper and the wicked don't get judged as they ought. God's promises would also not be able to be fulfilled. The wisdom literature reveals that this is a real problem and gets Israel to think about it. In the prophets, 200 years later, God begins to reveal that he will make a new creation in which all this is dealt with. His promises can actually be fulfilled. The problems of the fall can actually be dealt with properly. There is life after death where there is justice, and God's just greatness will be seen as all its glory. The new creation, in other words, is not an incidental random twist in the plot. It is a necessary and essential step forward. God's plan cannot be fulfilled without it. The fall cannot be reversed without it. God's justice cannot be seen to be done without it. God's word cannot be fulfilled without it. It is a necessary and essential part of the plot. But the new creation is something only God can achieve. This creation he made. The fact that we are now sinners and the world is fallen and cursed is something he has now inflicted upon us as a result of our rebellion. God alone can do something about it, and the way he has revealed he will do it is through a new creation. It is clear, even at this stage, even at the time of Isaiah and the prophets, that this means that the focus of what God is doing is the new creation. But it's in the New Testament, as we saw this morning, that this becomes really clear, that this world is not the answer. God's focus is there. The New Testament written there says it's all about there, all about there. Glimpse that here, focused on there. The negative implication, the negative corollary of all of this is also vital. The new creation is essential to all God is doing. It is the only place his plans can be fulfilled. It is his focus now, and that means that this world is not his focus. This world is not where he's fulfilling his plans. The problems, the great problems of the world cannot be solved in this world. That means it's not just that we should not lay up treasure in this world. God himself is no longer working to change this world. Well, I say no longer. He never was. But God is no longer focused on this world. He's no longer telling people to concentrate on this world. He has not told us in the New Testament to have anything to do with trying to reform this world. That is why there is nothing at all in the New Testament about reforming the world. Because God's plan has moved on from a focus on this world in this part of the story to a focus on a new creation which God alone can make in this part of the story. We live in this part of the story. It's really important to understand that this shift from this world to the new creation is not because God made a mistake the first time round. God didn't try it in this world, and oh, whoops, it didn't work. Therefore, I wonder what I'll do. God knew from the moment he cursed the world, in fact, before he made the world in the first place, says Ephesians 1, God knew that the new creation was the goal of the whole thing. But God has to reveal things in order. I mean, just imagine that you're an Israelite who knew nothing back there, okay? In Egypt, they were clueless. What happens if God at that point had said, well, tell you what, I'm going to deal with your sin and you're going to get a new creation. What would the typical Israelite have said? They'd have said, what? Don't understand. You're completely barking mad. Lock him up in the loony house. So God reveals gradually rescue, in categories you understand, from the land of Egypt, for the land of Canaan. Begin to understand rescue. Begin to understand that if you sin, it has consequences. Begin to understand that if you're righteous, it has consequences. And then when you've begun to understand those categories, we can tell you what they're really talking about. It's not rescue from Egypt for Canaan. It's rescue from this world for a new creation. It is not rescue from Egypt by the death of a Passover lamb. It is rescue from this world by the death of Jesus, God's own son. But you need to understand things like rescue, the death of a sacrifice, before you can understand that God is really talking about the new creation. But this means that once this world picture of what God is doing has been learned, God then needs to teach that it's not the real thing. Does that make sense? So back there, he needs to first of all teach that rescue is something he's in the business of doing, that rescue involves things like sacrifice, that rescue involves things like the judgment of the enemies, that rescue involves things like coming into something he's promised, like a land. And once you've got that, you think, okay, I now understand rescue. Rescue means I'm rescued from an enemy by God through a sacrifice for something else, which is a land. I've got it. God says, good, you've got that. Next lesson, it's not just from the physical land of Egypt for the physical land of Canaan. It's from this whole world to a new creation. The lessons need to be learnt in order, so they're revealed in order. And there are many, 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 many examples of this in the Bible. This idea of rescue not being about this world, well, being about this world initially and then not later, that gets mirrored in all sorts of other examples. So just think sacrificial system. You saw that just this last Thursday. In the beginning of the story, in the Exodus, offer all these animals and all these sacrifices. Come the New Testament, what does the writer to the Hebrews says, quoting Psalms? The blood of bulls and goats you do not want. It's the blood of Jesus that actually does the trick. The priesthood. In the Old Testament, you get Levitical priests who dress up like characters in the Mikado and prance around doing all sorts of animal sacrifices. None of that is relevant any longer. Jesus, the high priest, has come and done it once for all. All done. All over. In the Old Testament, you get all sorts of leprosy laws. If you've got a splodge on your skin, you're unclean and have to be excluded from the camp. All sorts of food laws that say you can't eat this and you can't eat that and you must eat this in order to separate the clean from the unclean. We don't do any of that now. That was all picture to help us understand the difference between the clean and the unclean. In the Old Testament, the focus was on the nation of Israel. They are God's chosen people, the Jewish people, physical descendants of Abraham. Now, it's people from all the world. Can you see, in area after area after area after area, God begins the story by, if you like, having a this world picture of something. And as the story evolves, he reveals that that was just a picture. Now that you've grasped the category the picture is talking in about, you can now understand the real thing, the real sacrifice, the real priest, real righteousness, the real rescue, the real land for which you're being rescued. It is a part of how the whole of God's plan works. So for us today to remain focused on establishing God's kingdom in this world, on this earth, is as silly and wrong as doing animal sacrifices. We all know that Christians shouldn't do animal sacrifices, don't we? We all know that food laws and leprosy laws no longer apply to us, don't we? We all know that God's chosen people are no longer the Jews. They are people from all the world who believe in Jesus. A rescue from this world to the new creation is exactly the same. It is not about focusing on this world. It is about a rescue for the new creation. That's why the new creation, I think, is so exciting. It's understanding that this, too, is part of this picture you see in the whole Old Testament of a shift from something which is just a picture to the reality which God alone can do. We have group time now. Let's go to the group and just think about some of the questions that are put there. If God's justice and promise, his word, if they're only seen working out now in God's new creation and not this world, what should our attitude to this world be? If it's not about here, if God's focus is not here, what should our attitude to this world be? What should our attitude to God's new creation be? To what extent do we love and look forward to it? And I think quite a few of the groups didn't manage to finish discussing the questions we had this morning, which doesn't surprise me. There were too many questions for that. So do revisit some of those questions from before lunch in your group to finish it off. Roger, can I hand over to you now?